Hello, friends. Today, our guest is Stephen Lawkin. Stephen is a Quaker physicist who for a long time has been studying the sciences of global warming, economics, and the political economics of our lives. And he conducts much of his research and studies through the lens of our Quaker values. Stephen is a member of Old Haverford Monthly Meeting near Philadelphia and has been working as an activist for many years. He is currently the executive secretary of Quaker Action Mid-Atlantic Region, an organization that is active in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Maryland. Quaker Action works to address climate change, reduce gun violence, and defend democracy by letting us know of the important legislation in progress in those state houses and by bringing our voices to those state legislators. So, welcome, Steve.
Thank you. So, Radner's developed a great framework for engaging friends with the climate crisis. Empathy, mindfulness, ecological integrity, right action, growth, and endurance. All of these will be needed if we're to emerge from this crisis and survive. As a young boy, I was growing up in the 1960s, and I was caught up in the space program. I mean, it was all over the place. And the Apollo mission to the moon was culminated in 1969 with a moon landing. And I fully expected that space travel would eventually become commonplace, that I would be able to fly on a spaceship, and it would be as like plane travel. So one thing that the lunar expedition actually brought back was a photograph of our little blue planet. It's an oasis of water and land wrapped in a very thin layer of air. And as Buckminster Fuller dubbed it, it's our spaceship Earth. Now, I was a great admirer of Bucky Fuller, and I read many of his books. And in my first year of college, I was privileged to attend a lecture by him. And he's best known for his geodesic dome, like the one at the Epcot Center. But he was also a champion of using technology to try and deal with the problem of how many people we need to feed on this planet and doing more with less. And one of the key concepts that he impressed me with was his idea of synergy. And synergy is the behavior of a system that can't be predicted. It's complex and isn't predicted by the behavior of the individual parts. An example would be ourselves. I mean, the human mind is composed of about 86 billion neurons, okay? And they're relatively simple. Each neuron is simple to model. Each one has some dendrites on one side. They connect to the other neurons around it, sometimes pretty far away, actually. And then an axon, which is a thicker nerve that carries nerve impulses to connections, synapses. And those connect, those are linked to dendrites, which then connect them to other neurons. So the basic behavior is that whenever the sum of the signals that are coming in from the dendrites on one side reaches a critical value, the neuron then fires an electrical impulse through the axon to the other neurons that are monitoring it. And that's, you know, pretty simple behavior. This, by the way, is how much of the AI world is being modeled. So the computer models are the same thing. You know, when inputs reach a critical value, it fires off, okay? And one might not expect such complex behaviors as we humans exhibit, like language or love, but or even the collected facts that ChatGPT can rattle off. And so, you know, this synergy is the idea that, you know, the simple model doesn't tell you what the whole system is going to do. So anyway, Bucky's talk inspired me to take up physics because it's a foundational science for all the other sciences. And I was determined to become a synergy engineer, which meant I needed to have a little bit of an understanding of just about everything. Maybe it was too ambitious. But a few years later, I was working for the General Electric Company in their space division. And I wasn't yet a convinced friend, but I had grown up in the Vietnam era. And so I was resolved to only work on defense projects or civil projects and not to work on weapons. And one of the projects that we worked on was NASA's Upper Atmospheric Research Satellite, UARS is what we called it. That was a spacecraft that was the size of a tractor trailer, It barely fit in the shuttle bay's, the shuttle's cargo bay. Now, the UR's satellite had some spectrometers on it and some other instruments that were able to give us an idea of what the chemistry was in the upper atmosphere. That is to say, what kinds of molecules are up there. And it was key in quantifying the depletion of the ozone layer. Now, ozone is a molecule that has three oxygens, unlike most of the air we breathe, which has two oxygens bonded together. And the ozone was being depleted by chlorofluorocarbons, and that was a problem because ozone is one of the ways the planet defends against the sun's ultraviolet rays. So it's sort of like a planetary sunscreen, SPF 30 or whatever. And without ozone, we might be more of a, you know, have more skin cancer and other problems. So the UR's data were important because they alerted the world to the growing threat of ozone depletion. And certainly seems surprising to me today, but world leaders actually came together in 1987 and agreed to the Montreal Protocol, which limited the use of CFCs. Yeah, so I continued to work on various NASA projects, and I was also attending a Quaker meeting at that time. I was working on devices that converted heat into electricity, thermoelectrics, and they powered NASA's missions to the outer planets. They had done so for Voyager. I didn't work on Voyager, but I worked on other projects, and these thermoelectrics provide power even where solar cells can't work because these satellites get so far from the sun that there's not enough sunlight. So I worked on the Cassini mission to Saturn and the New Horizons mission to Pluto. Meanwhile, General Electric decided to sell our group to Martin Marietta, and Lockheed Martin is the later incarnation of that. And of course, they're big weapons manufacturers. So in their reentry group, there was an engineer who heard about our work on thermoelectrics and asked if they could have me assigned to their group to work on fuses for nuclear warheads. Now, I, of course, refused their fuse work, since I was by then a convinced friend and coming to terms with the peace testimony. That was how I was called. So I talked to my boss and I was reassigned, but I saw the handwriting on the wall. I wasn't going to go anywhere after that. So I found work outside of the defense industrial complex. So like Aeneas, I'd been to the underworld and returned with an appreciation of what people will do in pursuit of profit.
Yes, Eisenhower did warn us about the defense industry spending nearly $1 trillion each year.
So now coming back to the climate crisis, how is it that in 1987 the world could all agree to take action to mitigate the ozone threat? But now, after more than a century of scientific evidence warning us about the link between carbon dioxide, which we're generating, and climate change, we can't get real commitments to take action. Why is that? Yeah, the first paper noting the link between the greenhouse effect and carbon dioxide was published over 120 years ago. It was published by a Nobel laureate, Svante Arrhenius, a Swede. He published it in 1896. And since then, the evidence that the threat is real, it continues to mount. There are many, many papers, detailing how it works. It's now overwhelming, and it's directly observable, not just to us scientists, but to non-scientists too. Ordinary people can tell the storms are stronger, the sea levels are rising, the oceans are warming, the coral is dying, and heat waves and cold spells are both more intense. So many people are still convinced, though, that it's a hoax. It's just some cyclical variation in solar radiation, or it's a natural cycle. We've been here before. Yeah, not since the dinosaurs, but... and then there's nothing we can do about it anyway, so why should I worry? All of that's false. We've been led down this, path by those who stand to profit by our inaction. And we need to change our course, or it'll soon be too late. Yeah, so returning to Bucky Fuller for a minute, he said something that hit me. And he said, thinking about what one little person can do, one little man could do, he said. So think about the Queen Elizabeth. That was the biggest cruise ship of the day. The whole ship goes by, and then comes the rudder, this huge rudder on this big ship. And there's this tiny thing called a trim tab at the very edge of the rudder. It's really just a miniature rudder. So you can think of the rudder, and then right at the edge, there's this little mini rudder. And it puts a little bit of low pressure, and it pulls the big rudder around. And he said it takes almost no effort at all. So Bucky thought we could be those trim tabs. And I agree. We could be those trim tabs by applying our Quaker values and raising our voices at just the right time and place. It's prophetic witness to this emergency. So what are some of the emerge ideas that will be essential in this course correction? And the first, of course, is empathy. For me, empathy grows out of our commitment to equality and our belief in the inner light. Empathy is a virtue, but it has survival value as well. So Keith Runyon talks about this in another one of these podcasts in this series. So for 200,000 years or more, and probably, 200,000 years or more, we've depended absolutely on one another for survival. We're not like a jaguar. We don't have phenomenal speed. We don't have sharp teeth. We don't have claws. We really can't go it alone. We evolved as social beings, social animals, who hunted and gathered for the survival, not just of ourselves, but of our communities. And the proceeds of this gathering and hunting were shared with the entire community. Perhaps the successful hunter might have gotten the first bite, but if he hoarded the, or she hoarded the proceeds of their hunting, it would not have been seen as a virtue, it would have been a vice. So we can talk more about tribalism later and how the tribal instinct has been hijacked. But in those hunter-gatherer days, empathy was essential because your survival tomorrow might hinge upon the empathy the rest of the tribe has for you today. Margaret Mead was asked one time, what's the first sign of civilization? And she famously said, it was a human femur bone, that's a big leg bone, that has healed. She pointed out that individuals cannot survive with a broken leg on their own. So this fossilized remains of a human femur that had healed from a fracture was evidence that somebody had taken the time to nurse the victim of that injury back to health. So definite evidence of cooperation. So few hunter-gatherer communities still exist today. There are some, but many of their values still persist. In South Africa, there's a story, maybe it's a legend. An anthropologist gathered the children together in a tribe and he told them that there's a basket of fruit over there, not far away. And whichever child gets there first can have the whole basket. But instead of racing to the tree, the children held hands and reached the tree all together. And then they shared the fruit equally. So when the anthropologist asked, well, why did you do that? Why didn't you just, race to the tree? And the children replied, Ubuntu. And that's the philosophy that I am because we are. So how could one child be happy if the others were sad? And so among the first peoples here in North America, and the idea that everyone eats from the same dish with one spoon is used to teach values of sharing and stewardship. So these are, these are common ideas in our hunter-gatherer ancestors, or among our hunter-gatherer ancestors.
So how do we get from the virtues of empathy and sharing to the virtue of selfishness?
That's been a long time coming. Our ancestors may have been encouraged to share within their tribe, but survival can also reward those who seize the opportunities as they appear. Gulls on the beach will steal food from each other, and unwitting beachgoers as well. So there's always been a push and a pull between giving and taking. But just when did the balance begin to tip? The conventional wisdom is that approximately 7,000 or 8,000 years ago, the land between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers in what is now Iraq was settled by the Sumerians, who began farming and eventually built towns and cities. The rivers provided transportation so that they could have trade. Agriculture was successful enough to provide a surplus. It freed some people from the spending most of their time hunting and gathering. Voila, you have a leisure class. Wasn't long before the priests and the soldiers worked together in support of some ruling elite. So initially the surplus was small, but most people still had to be engaged in agriculture or even hunting and gathering still, or guarding the surplus. But with trading partners, a food surplus could be converted into wealth. And that wealth surplus means that a wealth gap appears. The elites create a variety of justification for their special access to wealth and leisure, usually reinforced by the priests through religious beliefs and sometimes by the soldiers. Eventually, this new way of living, you know, led to city-states, kingdoms, empires, imperial ambition then dominated civilization for several millennia. Egypt and Kerma in Africa, the Roman Empire in Europe, the Xia and Zhang dynasties in China, and so on, right up to the present day. Of course, there were benefits of this surplus and leisure to some, but not to all. Advances in science and philosophy and art were all enabled by the availability of wealth and leisure, and usually they were provided by some powerful benefactor. For example, the de' Medicis in Florence. They were patrons of Galileo, Machiavelli, Michelangelo, and so forth. One must question whether Machiavelli, of course, was advancing or just brilliantly sustaining the status quo. Now, while he's best known for The Prince, in which power is maintained by those willing to be ruthless and brutal, he also provided insights into how a republic with elected representation ought to be structured. These ideas were echoed during the Enlightenment and eventually led to our own experiment with representative government. But returning to The Prince, it was a recipe for how to maintain a position of wealth and power against all those who would jealously try to take it away from you or whoever. In Machiavelli's time, the church taught that those with more had an obligation to take care of those with less, as well as practice other virtues like honesty and integrity. And Machiavelli counseled that, hey, you know, to maintain your power, occasionally you must sometimes act against your virtues. And for this, his book was banned by the church. Nevertheless, Machiavelli highlights a personality type that we still see today, one that engages in narrow self-interest, perhaps extending to immediate family, but one that considers the wealth and privilege that one possesses as deserved, and perhaps even self-made. Building on Machiavelli's foundation, the philosopher Locke argued that individuals have an absolute right to property, and resulting from applying labor to natural resources. Now, in 1776, we have Jefferson penning the Declaration of Independence and adopting ideas from Hobbes and Rousseau to argue for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Meanwhile, in the same year, Adam Smith is publishing his Wealth of Nations, and that established modern political economy by arguing that free markets with minimal government interference and the accumulation of capital would secure the future income of a nation. Free market capitalism was born. The invisible hand of the market was to ensure that abuses did not become excessive. I find it interesting that much of the libertarian free market enthusiasts seem to treat the economy as a zero-sum game. So in that whatever I have, you can't have. And whatever you have, I can't have unless I take it from you. So in cutthroat capitalism, this is often the case. Whether it's access to critical resources or market share, keeping my share of the pie means depriving you of your share. We see this today with the big efforts to cut benefits like SNAP and USAID, the Department of Education funds. But of course, nature likes to try all strategies everywhere all at once. So in parallel with all this, you have cooperative economies in which cooperation leads to a larger pie. And this is well known to those who study macroeconomics. It's the basis for the no tariff argument. Because, for instance, if you're better at producing tomatoes and I'm better at producing potatoes, then if I let you grow all the tomatoes and I grow all the spuds, well, there'll be more both tomatoes and spuds coming to market than if we each tried to grow both crops. Now, cooperative behaviors can enlarge the pie, so we don't have to fight over the last piece all the time. These behaviors are wired in by our evolution, where our ancestors had to be opportunists, seizing the day or the banana or whatever before anyone else buys it. But they were also social beings. They were often called to share the bounty, and so this creates a sort of inner conflict between self-interest and virtue, because it isn't really survival of the fittest, but survival of the group that leads to biological success. But the wealthy elites are having none of this group theory. They've touted the rugged individual, answerable to no authority but their own best interest. They've eroded our confidence in the common good in order to gain advantage to themselves. Elon Musk, in an interview with Joe Rogan, said, "Empathy was the fundamental weakness of Western civilization." This is central to their credo that unbridled capitalism is the only way. Yeah, so part of the problem is money. We've all heard that money is the root of all evil, but in truth, it probably shouldn't get all the blame. The standard rationale for money is that it provides a medium of exchange that allows for trading things of unequal value. Now, in a barter economy, you might not trade a horse for a chicken, but money can be divided into small units. So you can sell your horse for a lot of money and then use it, some of it, to buy the chicken. Now, coming back to that invisible hand, if I tell you that my hands are good egg layers and you buy one from me and discover it's not really, you might not buy anything else from me. I'll gain a reputation in the village as a shady dealer, and soon I will have to take my chickens elsewhere because nobody will talk to me, at least for a while. That's how virtue is reinforced. But today, our money is no longer tangible coin or even paper. We keep our money in banks, and they in turn facilitate trading via electronic debits and credits to the buyers' and sellers' accounts. Bits and bytes fly through the internet, but it's all intangible, and based on the faith that the banks will honor their accounts. This also provides a degree of anonymity that was previously impossible. I can purchase items from nearly anywhere in the world and have them shipped to my doorstep without any ongoing relationship between seller and buyer. Some websites offer a crowdsourced reputation score, but it is also possible to hide behind limited liability companies and other financial shell instruments if one wants to be unscrupulous. Now, cryptocurrencies take this anonymity to a new level, which is why it is the payment method for ransom if your computer is hacked and your data is hijacked. Nevertheless, free market capitalism is the core to libertarian philosophy and the conservative movement. Now, in his book, Common Good, Robert Reich describes how conservatism has evolved during the last century to promote the notion of the rugged individual as the ideal model of being in the world. The rugged individual is perceived as supremely capable, confident, and has the resources needed to deal with anything that the world can serve up. They're loyal to God, to family, to country. They're self-made. They've pulled themselves up by their bootstraps. They hold firm to the notion of private property and believe in the tragedy of the commons, and that prevents any workable form of socialism from succeeding. They look out for themselves and their own family and have little regard for the welfare of others. This is exactly counter to George Fox's 1656 idea of walking cheerfully over the world and answering that of God and everyone. Now, much of the modern school of economics is based on the ideas of Milton Friedman and the Chicago School, which seems constructed as if Margaret Thatcher said, "There is no alternative to global capitalism and economic growth." However, in the 19th century, Henry George became deeply concerned about one of the obvious flaws in this system: the disparity in wealth that arises between the rich and the poor. As explored in the 2023 film Ruthless, Georgia's Alternatives, economics, dismal science that it is, has touted the result of the mathematician John Nash. He won the Nobel Prize for his result that an equilibrium strategy, a chosen behavioral response, can be found for any repetitive non-cooperative game. His alternative, rather, was to have a tax system in which land was taxed at such a high rate that having large tracts of land would be unaffordable, even for the very rich, and land would essentially become a commonwealth commodity. Moreover, the tax would be all that would be needed to fund all the activities of the government. So it came to be called a single tax system. Now, Elizabeth McGuire promoted this idea with a board game that she patented in 1904. It was called the Landlord's Game. As the film goes on to point out, it is likely the origin of the Parker Brothers Monopoly game, though the objectives of the game are now quite different. The typical example that is used is the prisoner's dilemma, in which two people have committed a theft and have been caught. The prosecution is questioning them separately, but doesn't have enough evidence to convince on the theft, just the lesser charge of breaking and entering. Now, if both keep silent and cooperate with one another, they will get 2 years in jail for breaking and entering. Now, if one stays silent but the other gives testimony, the silent one gets 10 years for the heist, and the other one goes free. If both defect and rat out each other, then they both get the 10-year penalty. Now, Nash's conclusion was that the most effective strategy was always to defect. And this has been taken up by the neoliberal economists to justify a business model in which every transaction should be the one that maximizes profit.
But is there no chink in the armor?
Well, there are many variations to the ground rules for the game. And Robert Axelrod reported on an iterative version in which players are paired with other players randomly and play the game repeatedly. Now, each player keeps track of how the other players have acted in previous rounds, and they may alter their action in future rounds accordingly, with the result that selfish behavior may find early reward, but ends up having little or no profit in the long run. Of course, as the number of players increases, the chance of trading with the same partner decreases, and if we make it large enough, then we end up back with Nash's equilibrium. So I would say we're then at a critical juncture in social development where we've grown the size of our tribe much larger than ever before. But we expect that empathy for others and the common good, including the rule of law and honesty and so forth, will still persist. But now it seems perhaps not. Exploitative capitalism depends on being able to play the game repeatedly without your opponents being able to identify and punish you. And this is why our economic structures are designed to protect the owners and shield them to the extent possible from liability. Now, if I have an accident due to a defect in my car, the law allows me to sue the manufacturer for damages. However, if the manufacturer's liability exceeds their ability to pay, perhaps because the problem was widespread, our economic structure also provides for bankruptcy, in which case the owners forfeit their investment but are not liable for any further damages. So perhaps when Pandora opened her legendary box, what might have been inside was articles of incorporation. What do you think? So back to the chink. Money can be both part of the problem and part of the solution. One strategy that gets us back to buying local is local currency. In his book, Local Money, Peter North describes various systems that encourage community interdependence. Local money is issued, usually by a local business association, as currency that can be spent only within the community. Various businesses may accept a portion of the receivables in the local currency. An alternative to local currency is time banking. A time bank is established as a computerized database where each participant has an account. Typically, everybody gets a starting balance to start the process rolling. Now, if you need the services of a plumber, you might find someone in the time bank. And while you reimburse them for materials, their labor hours are deducted from your time balance. Now, perhaps your skill that you share is pet care or bookkeeping. Now, both of these systems get us back to face-to-face transactions. You get to know the people you're dealing with, and because they are your neighbors and friends, your reputation is on the line. Now, extending from this, online groups like Buy Nothing, Lower Merion lets you list things you no longer need for others to have free of charge. There's one in Radnor, too. I think it's called Buy Nothing Wayne. You can also ask for things that you need in the group, and this keeps things out of the landfills. It frees up resources for other concerns. For those who have a critical skill, they're used to being highly paid, for example, they might balk at exchanging their hours even up for the hours of lesser paid workers. But the advice for such folks is to give it a try, limiting the number of hours they make available to what they feel they can afford. Usually people find that they enjoy the one-on-one interaction and make friends, and that tends to make the investment worthwhile. So all in all, you develop empathy for the other. Now today, much business is transacted using what I'll call e-money. That is credit cards, tapping your phone on the console, cryptocurrency, online deals between persons on different sides of the town, or even different sides of the planet. Much of this e-money moves anonymously, or nearly so. Now, if you buy from Temu or Alibaba or Amazon, you don't get to know the people who made the product, or who stocked it, or who pulled it from the shelf, or who packaged it. Perhaps you get to know the delivery person who brings it to your door. Now, to compensate, some websites offer you the ability to rate your Uber driver or your Etsy seller, and they can sometimes rate you if you are, for instance, slow to pay or a difficult customer. But there's also much movement of money that supports a darker trade. In drugs, weapons, human trafficking, it flows into numbered accounts in Switzerland or the Cayman Islands, where bankers enable people to hide their business from those who would hold them accountable. Now, cryptocurrency is ideal for this untraceable movement of wealth because it does not need to flow through banks, where there is a required record of transaction, at least for large amounts. Instead, it moves in a peer-to-peer network. Peer-to-peer means one computer to another, and these computers don't need to be in banks. They could be two laptops on a, you know, person's desk. That's one of the reasons it's become so popular. However, the underlying blockchain technology that it uses could be turned around to capture the complete provenance of every transaction that it's ever seen. So unlike paper money, blockchain has been used and piloted by Walmart for tracking food through supply channels so that when a contamination concern arises, it's possible to determine every point of contact that handled that item. So back to that George Fox quote, "The spark of the divine that we seek to answer connects us in a web of interdependence that I believe is common to all of us." For me, that connection is sacred. The realization came years ago when an elder stood up at residential yearly meeting and sang a song that ended, "But the God in me is the God in thee." That this inner light is universal evokes the synergy that Fuller was talking about. So personally, I believe that it extends to all life on Earth and perhaps beyond. The more you look for these connections, these synergies, these symbioses, the more you recognize them and become aware of how much we are really all one with creation. Now, seeking atonement or at-one-ment is this, as a state of unity and reconciliation and harmony is paramount. Did you know there are networks of fungi that tend to copses of trees, moving nutrients that have no value to the fungi, or only to the trees that need them? A bird called the honey guide leads badgers to bee colonies and then feeds on the larvae once the badger has broken open the nest. Lichen are symbiotic colonies of funguses and algae that cannot survive without one another. Ants and aphids, the bacteria in your gut, the mitochondria in your cells that provide you with energy, all of these are part of the web of life. And if we could just visualize time as another dimension and could see the entirety of a person's life, you'd see that our lifeline grows out of our mother's womb like a bean sprout emerging from the earth and develops into an adult who perhaps spawns or gives birth to other life. And so in the temporal dimension, we humans are really part of a complex web of life that goes backward in all time, all the way to the first life on Earth. And though the web is pervasive, extending to all parts of the globe, it is also delicate and fragile and sublimely beautiful.
So, how does the climate catastrophe fit into the larger concern for the environment?
All right. So, recently, the crew of the Artemis II moon flight brought us a new photograph of spaceship Earth. Unfortunately, their achievement was eclipsed by news of war and conflict. Nevertheless, it is time to remind ourselves that we share this small blue planet with more than 8 billion people and a host of other species, all of whom share this commonwealth of a habitable planet in a remote corner of the Milky Way, and all of whom are depending on us humans, not to destroy it. Well, what does ecological integrity demand of us? The rugged individualists have promoted a concept of a lifeboat equipped for individual survival. So if you are rich and you can have a subterranean bunker located in some rural area that's far away from any military targets, bomb-proof, stocked with everything you need to survive the nuclear winter and fight off those who are less fortunate than you. And if you're richer still, perhaps you can go to Mars or to a space station, though there are some scientific difficulties with those ideas. When you realize that we are all on this spaceship Earth together, we really must come to grips with solving our problems collectively, in community, having empathy for one another. The climate crisis is happening, and so far there are no good tools for completely reversing it. If we can stop burning fossil fuels, we may limit temperature rise to, well, I don't know, 1.5 to 2, maybe 2 degrees Celsius. But beyond that, the warming is not uniform, and some parts of the Earth will become uninhabitable, not just for people, but for many of the plants and animals too. The maximum wet bulb temperature for us mammals is about 30.5 degrees C or 87 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, it's not the air temperature, but it measures how effectively you can cool your body by sweating. So exposures to such temperatures for more than 6 hours can kill. If global temperatures rise by 2 degrees C, cities like Kolkata, Delhi, these will all exceed 40 or more hours at that temperature. Sea levels are expected to increase by 18 inches here in the US and 2 meters by 2100. Deserts are expanding, permafrost is melting, habitat is disappearing, and wars are being fought to control what remains. The consequence is that large numbers of people will be on the move. So how will we adapt? Can we welcome the stranger? Will they come in peace? How will we be good stewards of our resources to aid the survival of other species? You know, Mother Earth will be fine whether we solve the climate crisis or not. The problem is that failure to act will essentially result in a reboot of life on Earth. Earth has weathered environmental apocalypses before. One of the first was about 2.7 billion years ago, when a relatively new species became so successful it permanently changed the atmosphere with its waste product. Does that sound familiar? Prior to the appearance of this creature, the atmosphere of our planet was mostly carbon dioxide, water vapor, and methane. Life has already made its appearance, but in a form of anaerobic bacteria that obtained their energy without using any oxygen. But this new cyanobacteria, they were different. They could do something called photosynthesis, using sunshine to convert carbon dioxide and water into oxygen and carbohydrates. So these photosynthesis-capable microbes were wildly successful. More and more oxygen was released into the atmosphere, and it displaced the methane. So gradually, over 200 to 300 million years, the atmosphere changed from mostly methane and carbon dioxide to mostly oxygen and nitrogen. So this great oxidation event completely changed the planet, resulting in an ice age, since the greenhouse gases were no longer there or dominant. Now, these anaerobic microbes were largely wiped out, since oxygen is like a poison to them. So there are some that remain. They survive in microenvironments like the deep sea hydrothermal events, or rather should say not events, but vents, near tectonic plates. So meanwhile, all this oxygen offered a new metabolic mechanism, and aerobic bacteria then became more prevalent and eventually morphed into complex forms of life. So Earth can adapt, but what has been is no more, and what is after could not have existed before.
Well, what do you think are the most promising ways to act right now and work towards resilience and endurance?
I'm glad you asked. My own work lately has been focused on a nonprofit called Quaker Action Mid-Atlantic Region, or just Quaker Act for short. It's a 501c4, which is to say a nonprofit that can accept contributions that are not tax deductible, and then it can use those funds to organize grassroots lobbying efforts to influence legislation and policy. Now, Quaker Act works at the state level here in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and soon will also be in Delaware. In much the same way that the Friends Committee on National Legislation, FCNL, works at the federal level. So Quaker activism is nothing new, and we find inspirational examples all through the history of the fight against slavery, the campaign for women's suffrage, the environmental movement, civil rights movement, anti-war movement, and so forth. What we are trying to do is just a small piece of that, but with big impact. Now, specifically, we are working on three priorities right now, and they are defending democracy and the climate crisis, and finally, ending gun violence. Those are our three priorities.
What other tools build resilience and endurance?
So mutual aid is a concept that developed during the labor movement, and it was instrumental in both the labor movements and the civil rights movements. It is needed now more than ever. It's a tool of resistance. This concept of mutual aid is part of defending the common good and recognizing that our commonwealth is not something we should allow to be privatized and plundered. The important feature is that it addresses a need and identifies an injustice that is the cause of that need. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, the Black Panther Party organized a free breakfast program for children that addressed the food needs of poor children in a number of cities. It identified structural racism that caused the problem and advocated for fair housing and community control of education and policing. It was a threat to the powerful elite. So the FBI and the local police were ordered to disrupt it. And as it was pointed out in Disney's 1953 Peter Pan film, all of this has happened before and all of this will happen again. And so it has now with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, engaging in racial profiling and cruelty while rounding up suspected immigrants for deportation. And so some people are again meeting the needs of families that now must live in fear of being kidnapped or worse by supplying them with groceries, transportation, legal help. Dean Spade states that mutual aid should have three key elements. The first, meeting a need and building a shared understanding of why the need isn't being met by the existing system. That's already been mentioned. The second is using the aid project to mobilize people and build a movement. And the third is participation by those receiving the aid, like Habitat for Humanity's requirement that the prospective homeowner must put in some sweat equity into their new house. So in summary, I'd like to say that it is the trim tab way of changing course that will be most effective, because such efforts are nonviolent and person to person in scale. Changing one heart, feeding one mouth, freeing one voice at a time. It succeeds because it is not a big thing that can easily be targeted, but instead it is many small things that taken together make a big difference. So I hope our listeners will sit in meeting with their friends and think about in their conscience as they did in George Fox's time and discern for themselves, how fares the truth with thee? Then in the time and place where they're needed, they will be called to give voice to speak to the wider world and take action on our emergent concerns.
Thank you, Steve. And that concludes this episode of our Emerge podcast series. We want to say thank you to Steve for showing us how many different values can work synergistically towards moving friends towards a realistic approach and give us a kind of merging of our scientific approach to it with our spiritual values. Thank you.